Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Alex Salmon from the American Prospect will explain why Mitch McConnell is pushing for blanket immunity for corporations, even in the most reckless cases. And Abram Lustgarten from ProPublica will be here to discuss how climate change is contributing to massive hikes in infectious diseases. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the show. You can help us out and help yourself out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. It's your support that keeps this show going. Here to start off the show with the news of the week, as always, Heather Digby Parton from Hullabaloo. So, Heather, I don't know, I feel like we say this every week, but this was a pretty heavy news week, particularly since, you know, there are the brakes are on, theoretically, right, for, let's say, the presidential race and theoretically for what Congress can do, although we're starting to see some hearings here and there. Folks are discovering Zoom and whatnot, and we will talk more about that in a bit. We obviously have states continuing to open up in quotation marks. Wisconsin, the state Supreme Court basically said that apparently the state has no role in protecting its citizens from a pandemic. That seems to be problematic and very well maybe down the road. But we also have, you know, the stimulus bill that the Democrats seem to be pushing to pass in the House on Fridays. We're recording this early Friday. There's supposedly a vote today. We'll see. But before we get to any of that, let's get to the real story, the one that everybody has been really, in many respects, afraid to talk about for years. And of course, I'm talking about Obamagate. Now, I thought for a long time that Obamagate was about the fact that Barack Obama, as you know, Heather, I believe you'll be willing to concede, was not born in America. He was, of course, born in Kenya. His father, I think, was, I can't remember who it was supposed to be, but one of the Black Panthers, I think. And his mother, I think, was probably the nanny or something. I'm not exactly sure. But he is clearly not American, didn't have a birth certificate, never had a birth certificate. One never existed, had no ability to forge a birth certificate, though he did have the ability when he was born to make sure that a birth notice was put into an American paper. I mean, it was all very well orchestrated. That's what I thought Obamagate is. But it turns out this week that we find out that's not what Obamagate is.
Well, no, this is a much, much, in fact, I believe from what I understand from, you know, Fox News and the president, it's the greatest scandal in world history. And to think that we didn't know anything about this until now, I mean, it's amazing how much it was covered up. And just as an aside, I just want to bring up something. I spoke with a friend of yours, I'm sure, and mine too, Joshua Holland, who he's made a distinction between Obamagate. He says that the gate suffixes actually should apply to real scandals, and Gazi suffixes should apply to pseudo scandals. So in this case, I think we probably should start talking about Obamagate as Obamagazi, because I think that makes it Obamagazi is a little bit more specifically attuned to the kind of scandal it is. And of course, you know, you and I are both being very sarcastic here, but the truth is that it's completely absurd. And what it does reflect is a kind of, you know, almost pathetic form of hysteria that they're trying to build on the right as a way of distracting from Trump's failures in every other way, and also, you know, a kind of a sad sort of attempt on his part to exonerate himself from the Russia investigation after the fact. Now, in reality, of course, that there is something real happening with Bill Barr, the attorney general, who is, you know, basically acting as the president's top henchman and going in and trying to use the rule of law to exonerate some of these people around Trump. I mean, he interfered with the sentencing of Roger Stone and has now withdrawn the charges against his former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, after the fact. And these are sort of ways, I think, of appeasing the president. And all of this is leading up to something with the Durham investigation, which is the investigation of the investigators that's been going on. And Trump and Barr both seem to be teasing that as having some kind of, you know, big revelations. We don't know what that is. But what they're trying to say is that, you know, the real scandal is that the Obama administration or people who worked in the Obama administration somehow tried to stage a coup after Trump was elected, and prior to that, tried to stop him from being elected. Now, of course, you know, the truth is that they actually put their thumb on the scale for Donald Trump during the election by going after Hillary Clinton and the email scandal, even up in the last 2 weeks. And there's more than adequate evidence to suggest that that was decisive, that Jim Comey coming out and saying they were reopening the email investigation actually was what made the difference in those states. No way of proving it, of course, but it certainly was a salient issue. And never mentioning that that they were investigating Trump for his alleged or possible collusion with the Russian government. So, in fact, went out of their way to tell the press, and the New York Times very ostentatiously put out an article saying there was no evidence that Trump was involved with the Russian interference, which, of course, was untrue. The FBI actually lied to the New York Times. So, this whole thing is just sort of meant to churn the whole story and make it all kind of seem like there's something there, and then you look at it and you go, and there's nothing there. But that's, you know, in a way, though, Sam, I really think it's kind of a pathetic action, because what it says is that Trump needs to gin up his base.
And I will say this, too, just because they did not I guess Obamagate, I guess the argument is that they could be both dastardly and super incompetent with their whole FBI deep state thing to get Donald Trump out of office. I mean, he's he was able to blow through the deep state's, you know, right, roadblocks, of course. But that is the most interesting thing about what you're just getting to now, is the most fascinating thing about the whole thing to me, is what, like, I got Benghazi, right? It was, the idea was, we're going to attack Hillary Clinton. The idea is we're going to say that she was up to something, like the secret server, and there are secret things in there that show that she was evil in some way, right? Like, it's like, we can't, nobody can disprove it. And yeah, evil and corrupt. And that was effective. And again, the Comey letter could have been it. The fact that Merrick Garland was never seated and there was an empty Supreme Court seat could have been it. The fact that Clinton didn't go to Wisconsin and Michigan to campaign. I mean, on and on and on. There's like a dozen different things that probably any single one of them would have made a difference in the context of that election. But the strategy that the Trump campaign followed was have people saying, a pox on both their houses. They're both so corrupt that I can't decide, and I'm just, it's not even worth it for me to go to vote. This doesn't seem to be anything like that. Like, this just seems to be completely, and that's the amazing thing about it. Like, and I know that, you know, we're 6 months out now, maybe, you know, 6 months out from the election, a little bit less, actually. It seems to me at one point you want to pivot to that maneuver where you suppress the vote of the other side. This whole thing that they're doing now, I mean, I get the idea that you want to shore up your base, but I sort of feel like you want to do that a little bit earlier. But I mean, where did, like, how, I don't understand. This seems like they're rolling out one production and it's just going to take the oxygen away from any other production that they were thinking about rolling out to actually run against Biden. I mean, all they're doing is reminding the vast majority of the country that the most popular president in our lifetimes is associated with this guy I'm running against. I mean, I don't get it. I really don't get it.
Exactly. And, you know, there is ample reason to believe that the fact that Hillary Clinton was unable to, you know, fully assemble that Obama coalition, particularly among African Americans, you know, that the turnout was down rather substantially among African Americans in 2016, that was, you know, part of the reason why she lost. So why would you bring out Obama as the foil, the one who's truly popular, that certainly African-American, Democratic African-Americans are going to go, whoa, wait a minute, you know, who are you talking about here? You know, that's ridiculous. So, I mean, basically what they're doing instead is you know, energizing the Democratic base rather than their own by going after Obama. That seems crazy. But then again, you know, Sam, these people, that this kind of chaos that we're seeing, political chaos. I mean, we'll talk about the actual chaos of the governance later, but the political chaos, I mean, that really speaks to the idea that I think that Trump himself has, I don't know, the political chops of the Republican Party have really atrophied over the past 3 years. And they're now sort of in this cult situation where whatever dear leader says is what they have to do. For him, it's tremendously important to exonerate him in this Russia investigation. I mean, clearly that's a big ego thing for him. I don't know that that has any real
electoral,
but yeah, I don't think it does. But, you know, I mean, for him, this is extremely important, and he has somehow or another convinced people, you know, the Fox News people, the media, the right-wing media, and maybe, you know, members of their base, that this is something that really means something, but it doesn't. I mean, I don't think it means anything as far as the electoral, certainly not in the midst of this pandemic. I mean, people are looking at the Russia thing going, you know, okay, you know, we did that, and everybody's taken their positions, but, you know, right now we've got people dying by the thousands right here in the United States, and we're a little concerned about that. So, you know, that's not a distraction. I don't think it's going to work, but I don't think they can stop him. I think this is just the stuff that he wants to do, and people are now kind of just following his lead. Maybe they've bought into this fantasy that he's some kind of an idiot savant when it comes to politics, and, you know, we better follow him over the cliff because he knows what he's doing. I don't know, but I think it's weird.
I have an alternate theory that I think is a little bit half-baked, but maybe not totally. And that is that we're looking at a hedge, right? I mean, there's some talk that, you know, first of all, we know that the Trump Jr. or one of the Trumps bought into own One America Network and took a big piece of it. There's some people who are saying that Brad Parscale is running a campaign that looks more like it's set up to create viewership for a network. And then if, you know, I think from Donald Trump's perspective, I think you're right. It's ego, but I think it's also a certain amount of like hedging insofar as if he loses, I think it would not be irrational for him to assume that he is looking at all sorts of potential charges. You know, Biden comes in, he's going to hire, you know, career-oriented Department of Justice people, and it's not inconceivable that somebody's going to issue indictments for Trump, you know, in the first month or two. I tend to doubt it because of the attitude of the Democratic Party, but one never knows. Maybe this is Donald Trump trying to establish his defense now, preemptively.
Could be. Some inoculation. Yeah.
I don't know, but it but clearly it is not going to be effective in the election. That seems to me to be obvious, at least at this point. I mean, who knows? Maybe they find, you know, that Barack Obama had a secret server in his bathroom that was actually like manned by Joe Biden. I don't know. But I can't see how it helps them electorally. And it is, you know, frankly, it's good news for Joe Biden. Because he announced this week that he's just going to be, you know, basically riding this one out in his basement in Delaware. And that's not a huge surprise. I think you and I had articulated when this whole COVID-19 thing hit that if you are Joe Biden's campaign manager, you've just been given a gift from heaven, which is not having to explain why Joe Biden's only doing one appearance a week or something.
Right.
You know, now you don't have, now it's just like it, nobody even asked the question, maybe, like, you know. And so I think in terms of the election, I'm just absolutely surprised by this. And in terms of, like, I mean, maybe it's clearly a base move. And maybe he thinks that this is distracting his base from COVID-19 or something. I don't know. But I've been just struck by how sort of nuts it is.
Well, it's interesting that you know, some of the polling, you know, is showing a couple of things that are sort of disturbing for Trump. I mean, obviously, his approval rating is what it's always been, and nothing seems to change that. But there are some cracks in it. I mean, one is amongst older people, his, you know, who are a big part of his base, people, you know, senior citizens and people over 65, they're pulling away from him because of his COVID-19 response, and they're not liking the idea that he's just basically saying throw up your hands and everybody go back to work and just, you know, do your thing for the economy. They're kind of going, hey, you know, I mean, we don't care to be, you know, thrown into the volcano as your human sacrifice. Do you mind? And his sort of paternalistic answer to that is sort of, well, we need to protect our precious seniors by keeping them at home for the rest of their lives. They don't really like that either. They're right. Not looking forward to the idea that they're imprisoned so that, you know, Donald Trump can have his good economy back or whatever. So that's a problem. And it's in some of the polling is showing some very severe erosion of his support in that group. And then there's another group. And you mentioned this earlier, was that, you know, people were sort of looked at the two candidates in 2016. They didn't really like either one of them, and some of them stayed home. But of those who didn't like Clinton and didn't like Trump, the majority of them, and it was a rather large majority, said, well, Clinton can't stand her, never could. Trump's new. I'll go with him and just see what happens.
Right.
This time, that same polling is showing the opposite. The people are going, I know what Trump is going to do. I'm going to go with Biden. You know, you look at these little bits of his base or people who voted for him in 2016 moving away. Combine that with the, you know, the white suburban women and, you know, the various African Americans who may be upset with him going after Obama. And, you know, it's starting to look pretty difficult for him to hold on to his base and not, you know, at the same time get, you know, energize the Democrats into coming out or emphasizing that weird sort of erosion of the people who don't like either one. I mean, you know, this is a very strange, well, I mean, obviously we've never had an election like this. It's the weirdest thing ever. In fact, they're going to do, it looks like, a virtual convention in a couple of months for the Democrats, and the Republicans are planning to have their convention, which I don't know how that's going to go. It's like the most infectious vector I can imagine. I don't know why anybody would go, but apparently they're going to do it. So this is just weird. It's just everything is very strange in this. And I get the sense that the Trump campaign, with their issues with Pascal, and apparently Trump is rumored to be very unhappy that Pascal has turned the campaign into a personal grift. That's for him to do. He doesn't like anybody around to do that. So he's a little upset with him, and that could be a problem, too. And there's talk that he wants to bring in Corey Lewandowski again, who was, you know, not the best. Hey, Manafort's out of jail. Maybe he could get Manafort back. You know, I mean, he did quite a good job for him last time. So, you know, who knows? But it's a mess. Let's just put it that way. It's a mess. And, you know, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah. Now, Trump, I mean, right now, Biden's got to be feeling pretty good, relatively speaking. And they're starting to make overtures to the left. Biden said this week in an interview he was for rent cancellation and mortgage cancellation and not a deferral, but in fact a cancellation, right, where the government steps in the same way that they're paying some salaries for the Paycheck Protection Program, they would come in and they would basically pay for some rents. I mean, that's a pretty strong policy decision in this moment. He's got the task force, and you know, I don't want to look. The proof is in the pudding, but the fact is that at least the ingredients look okay. You know what I mean? Like,
even sending those signals is a sign that his campaign, or at least are showing some concern, not on the merits for these issues and also for their own electoral base, you know, and saying,
right,
hey, you know, we hear you. We're doing it. And I also think on the economics, I think the fact that he's got Jared Bernstein in there is probably a pretty good thing. I think Bernstein's I think he's a legit progressive.
Well, Bernstein was his first,
right,
when he was VP, it was the top economic advisor at that time, too. I mean, yes, I think, like, look, there is some encouraging things. I don't want to overstate it. Like I say, the proof is in the pudding. But the pudding, we could be watching, you know, him be putting, like, you know, toxic stuff like, you know, coolant, air, you know, car coolant into the pudding. That's very sweet,
yes,
is my understanding. And and they're not, you know, they've chosen some pretty good people. So that is good. So let's move, though, to what the Democrats are currently doing. And, you know, we have this tension here, obviously, that people want to go out. They want this to be over. But the virus doesn't care. Virus doesn't care what we want. There is no speeding up the virus. But apparently, you know, we have the story in Wisconsin where the state Supreme Court has said the governor doesn't have a right to keep people from going into bars and hanging out, and it's nuts. But part of that is, you know, obviously not necessarily the bar, but part of it is also, like, I want to make a living. I want a job. I want to bring the economy back, which takes us to what's going on in terms of, like, the stimulus and aid. And we are in a situation, and you and I were, you know, we weren't the only people saying this. Obviously, a lot of people are saying this, but, like, if the Democrats, particularly in CARES 3, didn't go after something more ambitious, or CARES 2, something more ambitious, they were going to lose all their leverage, because once the Republican Party was able to flood the financial and corporate sectors with enormous amounts of money, the urgency went away. And Republicans are like, well, we're not going to necessarily look for another bite at the apple. And this should be the time where the Democrats are using that leverage to get stuff that they want. But so they're not. Nancy Pelosi's putting out a messaging bill. Okay, that's great. But the message is muddled. The message is quiet as possible, like designed to be quiet. The message is, we're not being that ambitious. To the extent that you can understand that what we're doing, let's just make it clear, we're not being ambitious, right? Like, so Pramila Jayapal and the Progressive Caucus wanted Nancy Pelosi to wait and give people time to read the bill and debate these questions. She did not want that. She wanted a vote on Friday. And it seems to me the reason why you do that is because you just want to get it over with. You want there to be something on the board so that your frontline people, when they're running for reelection, can point to that and say, I took that vote. I took that vote. I voted for that. I voted for that. My Republican opponent, him, he, that guy, because it will be a guy, he voted against it, or, you know, he wouldn't support it. And that's all she wants. But, you know, the sad thing about it is, like, it's not a messaging bill, because if you wanted a messaging bill, you would take Pramila Jayapal's suggestion. You would not just get it over with quick, because it's going to die. It's not going to the Senate. You'd have prolonged debate about it so the people could hear the message. And
that's the part I don't get. I don't understand. Why bury this thing? Because, you know, what's the point of it? Why even have the vote?
I think it's what I just said. I think it's honestly just so that in 6 months, the candidate can say, I voted for this, this, and this. And yet it becomes so unscrutinized that nobody really, you know, points out, like, hey, why would you subsidize insurance companies on the most expensive profit, product there is in the insurance world? Or, you know, like, why didn't you put in economic stabilizers, automatic stabilizers, so that if the unemployment rate does not, you know, drop as much as you hope it does, the unemployment will still be available. I mean, on and on and on. And they really shied away from, like, the most progressive stuff. And I think the way that they were going to handle it is just by having no debate.
Well, I mean, I just I don't even understand it that on the political side of it from her perspective, because if what you care about are these frontline moderates, which is so evidently what she cares about, having that debate is good for them, right? Because then you have the crazy socialist weirdos on the left demanding all this crazy stuff, and you've got your moderates going, hey, look, come on, we weren't asking for the moon. We're just asking for good moderate things. And, you know, look at me. I'm not a crazy socialist, you know, progressive weirdo next fall, if that's what they're concerned about, right? I mean, they don't want to be associated with things that are too crazy. In fact, Pelosi went out of her way to say, look, this is all just about COVID. We're not putting out our dream list. This is just about the pandemic and trying to fix that and blah, 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 because she didn't want anybody to be tagged with the idea. I think they're obviously afraid that somebody's going to say that they're using the emergency to pass their pie in the sky kind of ideological, you know, dream bill. So she's afraid of that. But that's what the debate would actually do for those moderates if they had it. And at the same time, you know, of course, put out these ideas. I'm very confused. I'll be honest with you. I mean, normally I can sort of suss out the political strategy, even if I disagree with it, I can kind of see what it is. And often I'll say, well, okay, that makes sense from her perspective. I disagree because I think, you know, you're better off doing this, that, or the other. I am stymied by what they're doing on this. I really am. I don't get it. I mean, even people who are generally very mainstream kind of, you know, middle of the road analysts like Michael Grunewald, for instance, yeah. You know, this is not a guy. I mean, he wrote the book on Obama's stimulus package and was very, very, you know, generous toward the Obama administration in that, in ways that I disagreed with. But even he is now saying, you know, what are they doing? What is this about? And this doesn't make any sense in this situation. So, you know, Sam, I mean, I'm really kind of throwing up my hands because I don't get it, and I don't see how the Democrats, I mean, well, even forgetting the politics of it, what the hell are they going to do? I mean, this is not sustainable. This, you know, they can open up the country. Okay, they can do that. They can do what Wisconsin did and basically said, hey, everybody, it's up to you. We're not closing anything down. You go out, you work, you do whatever. And screw all the workers who would be forced to go back to work. And if they don't go back to work, they lose their unemployment. They can do all these things. But they'll destroy the economy when they do that. This is not a reasonable thing to do in the middle of the pandemic, because as you say, the pandemic isn't political. They don't, you know, they're not red or blue state. I mean, it's just going to do what it's going to do. And the economy is not going to, you know, quote, come back just because people want it to. I mean, that's ridiculous. So they're going to have to do some things to prop it up. Even if they tell everybody to go back to work, they still will have to do that. And I just don't see what the plan is. Maybe it's just me. I'm not that smart, but I just don't get it.
No, I'm with you on this totally. And I also, let me just add the complaint of, like, you know, when she projects, and I understand why they say this. I mean, less and less, but I understand. But we're not doing anything radical in this. There does seem to be a lack of awareness by the Republican Party that the Republicans are doing exactly that, that they are, through these bills, structuring America to be someplace that is radically different than the place it is now in terms of wealth inequality and people access to capital and consolidation of businesses. I mean, they are promoting a very specific agenda. And the left really needs to, you know, and the Democrats, I mean, it's really just the Democratic establishment and leadership needs to sort of recognize this and respond in kind. I mean, they're the ones who are doing the radical change, and you're just sitting back and doing nothing and bragging about it. And, even if that is a viable strategy, right? This four corners strategy that we used to call it in basketball. The bottom line is that it's going to implicate what happens on day one. I mean, even your crappy Cobra thing, that just the nightmare of that Cobra thing, that runs out January 21st, 2021. It's like, hello? Like, even if you want to get rid of it at that point, like if Joe Biden's in there, You're going to have no leverage. You're going to get nothing. You're going to get nothing from a Republican Senate. Maybe they're going to filibuster. Yeah, you're going to be stuck with 30 million people without health insurance. And if Trump is in there, that doesn't do you any, you know, nobody cares. If you can't exercise the leverage now, you're not going to exercise it then. That's just a perfect example of how they don't seem to, like, they set up their own crises in some ways. Yeah. I'm not sure why, and maybe that's a topic for another day. But Heather, until next week, hopefully we'll still be here.
Yes.
Really appreciate your time.
Knock on wood. Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Top scientists from around the world who study infectious diseases and climate change have known that the increase in outbreaks, like the coronavirus, are inevitable. Here to discuss, Abram Lustgarten from ProPublica. So, Abram, I think it's, I think most people have at least some type of intuitive sense that our relationship with the environment has changed enough that some of these viruses that we're dealing with are a, you know, function of climate change and development. I don't know that there's, and I think you're right, that there is no evidence that coronavirus is a function of climate change. We do know that, like Ebola, for instance, was a function of human development encroaching on areas where there are bat habitats. But give us the broader picture on how we're doing in terms of, like, viruses relative to how we were doing, let's say, 20 or 30 years ago, and to what extent that is a function of climate change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the number of infectious diseases, viruses, and other new, what they call emerging infectious diseases, has been, as I wrote, skyrocketing. The number has just been significantly increasing every year, with several diagnosed a year now. And it's really just a question of if those actually spread into the larger population, which is when we notice them. But they're almost always occurring, and they're happening in the background, and more of them are being identified and studied every year consistently. They're clearly due to environmental causes, and those environmental causes are broken down between you know, encroachment on wildlands, deforestation, and you know, human-caused, you know, sort of destruction of wild areas, and, as I write, the influence of climate. Climate is, you know, as it is with most things, it's, you know, the CIA calls it the threat exacerbator. So it's rarely the single, you know, focused cause to blame, but it's always the thing in the background kind of making it worse. And so when you look at the emergence of diseases with environmental causes, climate is, you know, a smaller and growing influence. It's going to make them a lot worse in the future. It's a detectable influence now. And it's a greater influence than it was a decade or two ago.
I'm struck by the mechanics of it. I mean, there is that insects and rodents and smaller animals seem to be more successful in this environment. And it's almost like, I don't know, it just sort of feels like a metaphor for, you know, rotting wood or something like that, that it is. When things begin to degrade a little bit, it's not the bears you have to worry about in the country. It's the ants or the termites or the mice and the rats. But let's walk us through this. Like, how does this work? That climate change would exacerbate, and I guess give an opportunity for more infectious diseases to be revealed, I guess is the word.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, and it's the complexity, as you said, and the subtlety to it is, you know, is kind of mind-boggling. I mean, I've been an environmental reporter for 18 years and sympathetic to these issues. And I don't think I've ever seen before reporting on this story, such a sort of clear lesson in how, you know, the least expected and seemingly least important, you know, small changes can make a big difference, you know, in larger systems. And you see these subtle ripple effects that result in diseases, you know, in all sorts of ways. The primary connection that I was interested in reporting my story is the role of biodiversity and declining biodiversity in the emergence of infectious diseases like coronaviruses. And climate change is becoming the most significant driver of declining biodiversity around the world. So that's to say that, you know, as temperatures change and precipitation patterns change with climate, it changes the availability of food or the habitat, let's say the fauna, the plants that grow in a certain habitat for a certain type of wildlife. That stresses the population of that wildlife. Maybe it forces them into a population decline. Maybe it forces them to move, to shift slightly. They change their migration patterns, or they move slightly northward in search of more abundant source of a certain fruit on a certain plant that is their primary food source. And as they do that, they move closer to places where human development is coming from the other direction, through the establishment of farms or the deforestation for resources or the mining of minerals or oil and gas. And it's that interaction, that collision where these viruses are emerging. Wildlife hosts diseases. It's always been that way. And it's not necessarily the case that they host more diseases now than they used to. The diseases are much more likely to spread to people, and they are spreading to people as a result of this interaction than they ever have in the past.
Well, I mean, could in an alternate universe, right? I mean, one could think that, like, okay, the lack of the narrowing, the shrinking of biodiversity, oh, that'll knock out a bunch of carriers of viruses. But in fact, it's the opposite. I mean, what is the mechanism that is? Like, you know, that's not a coincidence, right? I mean, there is, it has to do with the nature of viruses, of these, of the carriers of the viruses that make them more durable in some fashion.
Yeah, I mean, there's studies on both sides of this issue, but I was really interested in the prevalence of what scientists call the dilution hypothesis, which is essentially this, you know, boiled down is, you know, this idea that, you know, there's strength in a system that is diverse, and it's weaker the less diverse it gets. And so that's to say that there's, let's say there's a dozen viruses in an ecosystem of 1,000 species. Those viruses travel around, the immune systems to fight them off are strong, and they tend to peter out without going very far. And as the species pool declines to, say, 100 species, some of the some of the strongest immune systems that might have dead-ended a particular hypothetical virus don't exist any longer. And so the virus finds, you know, more traction in those remaining species, and it tends to spread further. And once it spreads further and grows to a certain, you know, level, it then has, you know, inertia and momentum that allows it to make that jump, potentially into the human population as well.
That's fascinating. I mean, that is the case also. I mean, I think they found, it really is, because you could, intuitively you could think like it's the opposite on some level, that maybe it has the, but it really basically just says, it's almost as if it's like a combination lock, and we're moving from like five turns of the dial, five different numbers that you got to hit, down to like three, and the odds are just better that the virus is going to be able to hop, jump, and skip between these three as opposed to the five.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's also the issue of which species survive, and some species, you know, carry viruses or other emerging infectious diseases better than others. So that's to say that, you know, as biodiversity declines, or the number of species declines due to climate or due to other pressures, the predators disappear, and what emerges, with an absence of predators are, as I wrote about in my piece, rodents and bats, for example. And those are two species that are incredibly prolific in spreading infectious disease. Between the two of them, the vast majority of diseases are spread by, you know, mice and rats and bats, which serve other purposes. So we don't want to get rid of them, but their thriving populations allow for, you know, a greater abundance of disease. And then those rodents especially, they prosper in close proximity to people. So whereas, you know, elephants are going to die out as human settlements get closer, the rats are going to find food sources in our trash cans, and the bats are going to build nests in the eaves of our buildings. And again, that proximity brings them in a collision course where the viruses that they carry, have a greater likelihood of then connecting with people.
Is there something beyond our encroachment that also makes us vulnerable that has changed, or no? I mean, I'm fishing here. I'm just curious, because are there ways that we structure ourselves and our lives outside of the fact that we're encroaching that make us more or less vulnerable?
Yeah, from a systemic perspective, I mean, the links are, in terms of viruses, it's declining biodiversity driven in part by climate change that is leading to a greater likelihood of viruses jumping to people. The extent of global travel before, you know, this current pandemic is another. It doesn't increase the likelihood that a human being gets infected by the virus, but then it exponentially increases the likelihood that once a human being is infected, they will infect others who will get on an airplane and skip across continents and go to a music concert and infect 1,000 more people and so on. Travel, our globalization, the interdependency of our economies, all these things, just population growth alone, the fact that there's 7.6 billion people on the planet now when there weren't a couple of decades ago, all of these things, you know, contribute to the, you know, faster and broader spread of disease once that sort of spark starts the wildfire, so to speak. That fire is going to spread further and faster.
We're talking to each other from our respective homes, so maybe this question is a little bit has already been answered, but how are we doing in terms of competing with these viruses?
Yeah, I think that's difficult to say, and maybe outside the bounds of my reporting. I mean, what I did hear and what was very concerning to me, is the extent to which, from a policy perspective, the American government is not supporting the kind of research that was making progress against these viruses. And I don't know if that quite means, you know, that we're losing, but it certainly means that there's missed opportunities. You know, for example, you know, I looked at, a National Institute of Health program and a U.S. Aid program called PREDICT that had been funding research in South China, which is one of the hotspots, a jungle hotspot where a lot of emerging diseases and viruses are coming from, and probably where the COVID-19 virus has come from. And the researchers involved in that program described to me that, you know, their holy grail of ambition, which is that they might have been able to, or they might soon be able to develop a vaccine for a whole family of viruses. That's to say that we don't wait for COVID-19 and try to develop a virus, but we develop a proactive, vaccine that could, defend us from, 100 different kinds of coronaviruses that all have some similarities. And that work was interrupted in late 2018 when, the current administration cut funding for it. Then in, 2019, when it yanked staff out of China. It's been extended on sort of a temporary basis now just because of the current crisis. But in general, we haven't supported that kind of research, and we haven't supported the kind of science that might lead us, to be able to take anything other than a reactive stance against these diseases.
So the Trump, or because I hadn't heard this, I mean, there's about a half dozen, it sounds like, things that the Trump administration did to make us less prepared for this, but they pulled the funding for PREDICT. When did that happen? In 2017 or 20?
Yeah. So the funding funding cut was announced in late 2018. The program it's a global program, so from Central Africa to Malaysia to South China. I was most interested in my reporting in the parts of the program in South China. That was cut and canceled by the end of 2019, actually just a couple of months before the first COVID-19 case was diagnosed. You're probably hearing a lot now about this, these theories that the virus was released from a lab, a biological lab in Wuhan in China. That's a lab that's connected with this USAID funding. That's a place where they had been studying the viruses that that scientists affiliated with this USAID program, this PREDICT program, had been bringing out of the jungle to study their genetic makeup and try to understand their potential better.
Well, Abram, thank you so much for your time today. It's fascinating stuff, and also a little bit terrifying, even as we are living in the midst of a pandemic now. I spoke to an epidemiologist on this program, I guess about, 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, and asked him what his greatest fear was. And he said, COVID 2022. And, frankly, it may not come in 2022, but there's a reason to believe that on the path we're headed, it's coming again. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest. I appreciate that.
Abram Lustgarten is a senior environmental reporter with ProPublica, with a focus at the intersection of business, climate, and energy. He's currently covering changes at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and working on a project about pollution at U.S. defense sites. Mitch McConnell's relationship with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has made its way into the Kentucky senator's latest plan to provide blanket immunity to businesses and corporations in order to quickly reopen the country. Here to discuss, Alex Salmon from the American Prospect. So, Alex, we've got a situation. We should say that we're recording this before the vote that Nancy Pelosi is going to hold on Friday for the Democratic version of the Phase 4 or Coronavirus 4 bill. She's calling it the Heroes Act because, I guess, why not be as ham-fisted as possible? It is a $3 trillion bill. It's largely a messaging bill. But let's start with what you've written about, which is Mitch McConnell's line in the sand about basically immunizing corporations from any type of responsibility for bringing their workers back into an environment that is not safe because presumably the corporation has not done enough to keep them safe, you know, providing personal protection equipment or separating them with plexiglass. Same too, I would imagine, for its consumers. And corporations just don't want that liability. And so it seems to me that Mitch McConnell has made this the line in the sand because, frankly, they've gotten just about everything else that they wanted in this in phases 1, 2, and 3.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's blanket corporate immunity is a proposal that's it's so ridiculous, both so unpopular and so unnecessary. It's hard to imagine bringing this forward with a straight face in any other circumstance. But when you're on a hot streak, there's no reason to slow down. So obviously Republicans have maintained almost total leverage in the situation, and they've gotten basically everything they've gone after. And so, you know, yeah, when you're on a roll, why not? And you know, blanket corporate immunity is something that I think even the number of trade groups, big law outfits who represent large corporations, even they are not that comfortable with what that would imply and the standard that would set for the larger business community. But Mitch McConnell doing the absolute bidding of the Chamber of Commerce has kind of, it's just so few things left on the list that this has now risen to the top.
And this is the thing that I don't understand. Why do the Republicans always seem to have the leverage, regardless of whether they are in the Democrats' position in terms of just controlling one house and not the presidency in the Senate, or vice versa? I mean, why is it that the Republicans have the leverage in a situation where theoretically they're responsible for the response of the government? They have the presidency. They have one of the houses of Congress. They also have the Supreme Court, I guess. I'm not sure, how that would play in. But why is there no leverage with the Democrats? I mean, I'm also not convinced that McConnell's not just like picking something off the shelf so that he can give it away and make it look like, in this kabuki theater that they're giving up something so that the Democrats don't really ask for anything that the Republicans don't want.
It's a great point. And yeah, I think there are many reasons to believe that hypothesis might be correct. I mean, first of which is the fact that the legal protections that exist for corporations and companies in this country are immense, are far beyond immense. They're so broad reaching that it's basically impossible for them to stand to be exposed to serious liability in the first place, or at least to legal action for it. So yeah, that's a great point to bring that up. It's not entirely clear that this is even something that would help that much or change the game that much for these groups. But I think it does kind of speak to a lack of clarity on the Democratic side as to what the ambition is, what the message is, what the vision might be, both for how to deal with this and how society might look after this. And I think that kind of segues conveniently to the Democratic proposal that we saw come out, kind of trickle out late on Tuesday as people started working through the many hundreds of pages of the draft text. And again, that bill was introduced, Coronavirus 4 or the HEROES Act as an ideas bill, as something that was, much of this is not going to make it through, right? There are things in there that are almost certainly not going to withstand the deliberation process. And so you wonder why a bill that is basically just a showcase of values or of aspirations. Why are there so many things in that bill that seem like they would be antithetical to a liberal or progressive or, moderately democratic agenda? And yeah, I think that all goes to kind of a lack of clarity as to what a democratic agenda even looks like. And that sort of thing may look very different to Nancy Pelosi than it does to some of us or to Democratic voters or, to various members of the House who thought they were getting certain things in the bill and then found out that it was that they were nowhere to be found. So,
all right. Well, let's get a little more specific. And I Full disclosure, I think Nancy Pelosi is got a very specific agenda with this. I think it just happens to be one that is so, I think, contrary to the conventional wisdom of what the Democratic Party is supposed to be doing in this instance, that it appears as if she has no idea what she's doing. I mean, it's that, I think it's that bad, frankly, because first off, let's just start with this. There is, like you say, this is a messaging bill, right? We know that, and McConnell's already said this is dead on arrival. And why does McConnell say it's dead on arrival? Because he doesn't want it discussed. He doesn't want any of these asks by the Democrats to be contrasted with what Republicans will give, because he is concerned that there may be some stuff in that bill that it's embarrassing that the Republicans won't do, right? Let's say like contact tracing or what, and these are elements of the bill, sending money to states and municipalities. But the fact of the matter is that Nancy Pelosi has basically told her caucus, we got to pass this on Friday because we need to do it urgently. Well, of course, you don't need to do it urgently. The Senate's not going to take it up, period. And the Senate is not inclined to do anything till well after Memorial Day. The fact is that the longer this bill is floating around and being debated, the more of a message that it starts to talk about. Right. I mean, how do you have a messaging bill where nobody even discusses it after Friday because it's passed and it's dead on arrival and end of story? And so I think, you know, and you've got Pramila Jayapal saying, hey, we want time to digest this. She's saying, no, we've got to go quickly. I mean, that's just from a process standpoint. I think that is showing her hand. Then let's go through some of these things. We're talking about it's a $3 trillion bill. Almost a trillion of it goes to cities and states. That's needed. But what's the other $2 trillion?
Well, there's an array of provisions in here that are, you know, some would say cringeworthy, some would say inexplicable. I would say many of them are unappetizing, to say the least. So, yeah, you know, that the good stuff. You know, money for states and municipalities, incredibly important, obviously essential stuff. The devilish details are kind of deeper in the bill, and chief among them, I think, is there's a provision that would bail out corporate lobbying shops, and you know, so all of the K Street lobbying firms would be eligible for paycheck protection program funds. That actually would extend also to 501c4, which are dark money organizations. So you have a pretty healthy bailout for the lobbying and dark money arms of the political process, which is, you know, those groups don't tend to be, you know, particularly enthusiastic about progressive aims or even, you know, Democratic politicians in general. There's a bailout of mortgage servicers, which is, you know, another thing that, you know, if you remember the last time we went through economic crisis, this is you know, this sort of thing is going to give you PTSD. The idea that we again need to bail out these mortgage servicers, despite the fact that they're already getting you know, quite a substantial help from the Fed. We have massive subsidies for health insurance, private health insurance companies, in the form of COBRA subsidies, and that's not even exhaustive. You know, we can go down the list, and there are things that I think are more palatable for some. There are obviously a handful of different tax breaks for the wealthy in terms of SALT deductions and in terms of.
Yeah, let's just park it there for a minute, right? Because one of the things that Jayapal wanted was a proposal, I think it was about $650 billion, to, instead of having this sort of Rube Goldberg contraption where banks end up loaning money to small businesses, and if they spend 75% of the money that they borrow from the bank, then it's they spend 75% of it on payroll, then it's forgiven. And having all of this sort of like rigmarole in terms of applying for the bailout, Jayapal would just pay companies to pay their workers to stay at home. And that was considered too complicated and too expensive. Meanwhile, Richard Neal, who is you know, basically Nancy Pelosi's guy on taxes, and so also true of the healthcare industry, Neil is proposing some type of tax credit scheme that's worth about half that. But of course, the SALT clawback helps only the top 10-20%. I mean, almost 90% of the benefits go to just extremely wealthy people in places like New York and California. All well and good, but I mean, we're spending money on tax cuts there and denying people the ability to maintain businesses, to maintain their employment, even if they're not doing anything for that employment at this moment. And then on top of it, we've got now about 30 million people, maybe I saw Axios was reporting this week, maybe it was like 27, 25 million people without health insurance because they've lost their employee sponsored health insurance. And instead of coming up with, you know, coronavirus care or just like expanding Medicaid for these people, we are now subsidizing health insurance companies. This is the Democratic bill to pay for the most expensive health insurance product, I don't know, known to man, you know, Cobra. Like, has there ever been in the history of the world a more expensive insurance product than Cobra? And we're subsidizing that? This is just, it's bizarre.
It is, you know, it's kind of that, the perfect nexus of extremely inefficient, extremely expensive, and also extremely unpopular. So, you know, there's not a person on earth, I think, has ever exalted the Cobra benefit as something that they are particularly enthused about. So just, you know, even from an optics perspective, again, it's the sort of thing where it's kind of a head scratcher. It could indeed prevent people from losing their health care if they've been fired or laid off during this time. But of course, if you could just have prevented them from getting fired or laid off, or if you want to allocate, you know, a gargantuan sum of money to provide health care for people, there are much more efficient ways to do so rather than routing it through, you know, United Health Group or Blue Cross Blue Shield or whoever else. So yeah, it's kind of confounding on a number of levels. And again, there may be some marginal benefit to it. There may be some marginal benefit to the SALT repeal. But again, it's so circuitous and so inexplicable when there are these very simple solutions to seek these out is, you know, extremely confounding and I think very frustrating for a lot of people involved.
Absolutely. I think I'm displaying some of that frustration, and we should say yes, if you give tax cuts, there is usually some stimulative benefit. But of course, you're giving it to the wealthiest people in the country, and it is not targeted. And I mean, there's only so many things you can buy, you know, on Amazon. You're not going out and buying another house on this stuff. And so it seems to me, and let me bounce this off you, because every time I criticize Nancy Pelosi, inevitably I get an email saying well, what would you do? And it just seems to me that if you were going to do a messaging bill, right? And presumably it is, the idea of the message is you're building your brand and you're contrasting it with the brand of your main competitor, which is the Republican Party. Maybe you could go as far as even the proposal, the very modest proposal of your own presumptive nominee, right? Like, why not say we're going to open up a public option in the Obamacare exchanges, and we're going to service, you know, we're going to do just a subsidized scheme like we have for Obamacare for all these people. I mean, that's what Joe Biden's proposal is on some level. If you wanted to have a messaging bill, I mean, it sort of feels to me that the job number one of the Democratic caucus, the leadership, is to make sure that they don't set any markers that in any way constrict and force any type of progress in these major issues. I mean, you had said earlier, you know, that the Republicans have had a transformative agenda. You know, we heard a lot during the Democratic campaign about structural change. The Republicans have engaged in structural change to our economy in the way that they have structured these bailouts. And Democrats have just stood by and allowed them to do so. We're going to have much more monopolies. We're going to have much more successful corporate interests because of the way that they doled out this money. Democrats, meanwhile, just seem terrified at the notion that anything good could come out of this, anything new or any new development. It feels like their job, they see it, is to corral any ideas that would be suited to address this moment.
I think too. Yeah, I think that's a great point, and that's, you know, sadly very on the money. I think even to add to that, it does feel as though Democrats and Republicans are kind of playing on two different fields here, where the Republican proposals and stuff that they have won so far and the stuff that they continue to win is basically all about the world that we're going to live in when this is over, or, you know, when the most acute effects of this virus are behind us, which means that they're radically transforming the world that we're going to live in. They're setting the parameters. They're changing those rules. They're putting in motion the world that will be. Whereas these ideas you see coming from the Democratic side of the aisle are pretty much all retrograde in a lot of ways. They're all reactive, and they all seem to be pretty much trained on the very immediate moment, or the stuff that, you know, should have happened 6 weeks ago or already happened, right, you know, weeks and weeks ago. And so, yeah, we're kind of seeing two different games being played here, and the Republicans are very much looking out towards the world that is going to exist. Well, Democrats are at the behest of Nancy Pelosi, very much looking backwards, or if they're looking forward, it's with very, very short-term vision. And that does set up, horribly for a potential Biden administration. If Biden were to win, the Republicans will have already set the terms on the world that he is going to inherit, or, you know, would inherit as president. So, yeah, it lacks ambition, lacks foresight, and it's certainly you'd like to see one policy or one proposal put in place that would exist in the post coronavirus world that might, you know, have an impact on that world, and I fail to see that in this bill.
Yeah, that I think is a great point, Alex. There is nothing that will have implications past this era. And it will just be stuck with a major bill. Like, there's no infrastructure. There's no investment in anything. It's just taking the money and being as uncreative as possible as you can, and going out and burning it, and not even like burning it and storing the energy in some fashion. One of the things, and now that you mentioned that is also really missing from this bill is any type of benchmarks, any type of like automatic quality to these economic stabilizers. So in other words, we have no, as far as I can tell, and you tell me, because you may be more familiar with it than I, but there are no benchmarks that must be attained for these programs to end. So for instance, we're doing some type of unemployment support. Unemployment needs to be down below 5% before we stop paying out this stuff. That doesn't exist. The only thing I can see is that they've done a temporal one with the health insurance that on January 21st, 2021, the COBRA stuff ends. And it's like, if the Democrats are in power, you have now handed the Republicans this massive leverage point, because it's the Democrats who are going to get blamed. I mean, that was sort of where we started with this thing. But let me, are you aware of any of those type of economic stabilizers that go through, you know, even maintaining this so that it's on autopilot? We don't have to rely on Mitch McConnell to re-up it if Joe Biden's president. And B, let's talk a little bit about voting. As far as I know, there's money in there for voter protection, but there isn't any explicit vote by mail provision. Is that the case?
Yeah. Well, to your first question, I think you raise a great point there, and the fact that the limits that exist on the stuff that's out there, and on most of the stuff that's being proposed, either comes with an expiration date or a hard cap on dollar value. And so, you know, that was the issue we saw with the Paycheck Protection Program the first time around. Is you know, why was it so small? Why was there a hard limit on how much money could be doled out on that? And then obviously, you know, there's a cascade of issues that set in after that. And again, yeah, and then same thing with COBRA. Why is there an expiration date? Why don't we set these things to benchmarks that actually, you know, would indicate or evince an improvement in the quality of life or sustained solution to these problems? I haven't seen any of that. And I think that is a major concern. In terms of the voting stuff, I actually haven't spent enough time with that part of the bill to know the particulars of it. I do believe there's money for the Postal Service in there. I do believe there's money for voting rights. Voting right protection. I don't believe that universal vote by mail as such is in there. And I think if you are a close watcher of the news cycle, there were four separate states, Republican states, I think within the last 24 hours that have taken, you know, strong moves to prevent vote by mail. And these kind of stories trickle out kind of constantly. So it's almost hard to keep track of them. But that obviously is a major sticking point for Republicans. They don't want it. And they are very proactive on that front. And I don't think that there's, at least to my knowledge, something in the bill that would overwhelm that opposition or that would kind of set that in place to make that a part of the November election. So that's another thing that would be nice.
Alex Salmon from the American Prospect writing about the absolute absurdity of blanket corporate immunity. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Alex Salmon is a staff writer at the American Prospect. You can read his piece, The Absolute Absurdity of Blanket Corporate Immunity, over at prospect.org. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire. Special thanks to all of you who are listening to this show for free on Stitcher or iTunes or wherever it is, and specifically those who converted into members this week. Thank you very much. It is your support that keeps this show alive. And if you are listening to the free one-hour podcast, consider becoming a member. Full show is giving you a couple more interviews and a couple more information, and it is the way that we produce this program. You can do so over at rofpodcast.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com for more info, and you can also come over and check out my daily show. I do it live every day of the week at majority.fm. It's available later as a podcast. Look it up. Majority Report with Sam Cedar. I'm Sam Cedar, and this has been Ring of Fire.